with Chris Castellanos, and I have a special guest today. He is my horn professor, just an all-around amazing horn player, Bill Bernardes. He's played with many orchestras, but his main position is principal horn with the Las Vegas Philharmonic. He's the horn professor at UNLV in Las Vegas, and he plays with the Chautauqua Symphony Orchestra. He's been there many years. It's just a pleasure to have him, my good friend, Bill Bernardes. How's it going, man?
Oh, it's going great. I'm really so fun to be here with you, because when we're this day and age, just getting to talk to people like this, we're all sitting at home.
I know, right?
No, this is fantastic. And I'm in Chautauqua now, and like everybody else, we're not really working, but we have a house up here, so we came up, and I've been making little videos and whatnot. But anyway, yeah. Keeping busy.
Well, this is a fun, like, interview kind of podcast thing, where I call it Music on the Rocks, because one of my favorite parts about being a musician is after the concerts, when you go out with your friends, you hang out and you just catch up, and music on the rocks. So I ask all my friends to bring on a nice beverage, a libation, if you will. What's your fancy today?
My drink of the day today, as you well know, I'm a tequila freak, but I've made myself a little double margarita tonight.
Oh, baby.
And I have this tequila up here that I found. It's called Hotel California, which is interesting. but anyway, I thought this would be a fun thing to do, and it's nice and outside and refreshing.
Well, I've shared many a margarita with you, and it's funny, I rarely ever drink margaritas anymore because you've kind of spoiled me. So the only time I ever have them are over at your place. They don't taste right if I'm not drinking them with you. You're pretty well known in Vegas for your
Well, in a close circle, people like my margaritas.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I, in your honor, decided to bring a tequila in. Do you know this one?
Oh yeah, Husson's. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a nice little one from Ensenada there.
That's right, the supposed inventors of the margarita.
Hey, well, I didn't know that. Cheers to that. Well, cheers, man.
Cheers to you.
All right.
Good to be seen, and good to see you as well.
Well, cool. So what have you been up to? You say that you're not busy, but I know you've been keeping busy, and I've seen the UNLV interviews that you guys have been doing, and I've seen some videos that you in particular have been putting out, which are really, really good, and it's just a lot of fun to see all the creativity that's been going on lately, you know?
Well, I mean, we've been here for just a little over a week now, and of course, we took about a week to get here. We drive across, and we pull a travel trailer, and we find nice places to stay and be there. And so before we left, though, I had made a small handful of little videos. I did a quartet, I did a sextet, and since I've been here, I've had other projects that have been coming up, like the group from the Las Vegas Philharmonic are doing two movements from the Beethoven sextet, which is going to be interesting. So I just recorded that today, actually, second and fourth movement for the Beethoven sextet. And that's going to get put together and put out by the Las Vegas Philharmonic. What did I just do a couple days ago? A good friend of ours, Nathan Tenaway, he just wrote a fanfare for the UNLV Brass, which we just recorded. And somebody who I'm looking at right now joined us on that recording, Chris. And it's going to be debuted on Saturday when, remind me to get back to this later, when we interview Chris Castellanos on the UNLV Brass Facebook page, Facebook Live. It'll be great.
Yeah, I don't have the high notes that you've got in that sucker, but that's Nathan. We went to school together, and we were college roommates, and I mean, he's such a good writer, but he always writes really fun stuff, and I love that he wrote this fanfare. That's really a fanfare. It's not a weird beeps and boops and stuff. Yeah, this is a fanfare.
It's very cool, and it's a full brass choir, too. It's, you know, four trumpets, four trombones, four horns, and a euphonium and a baritone, so it's completely, sorry, euphonium and a tuba, but it's very hip. It's 40 seconds long, but it's a power-packed 40 seconds.
Yeah, well, hey, man, that's what a fanfare should be, right? And you walk into the room and you make a statement, and You don't want to overstay your fanfare. What else have you been up to? I mean, I know that you really love it over there in Chautauqua. Actually, tell me a little bit about how you got into the Chautauqua Symphony.
Well, a billion years ago, you may have heard of this group called the Dallas Brass. I think you might know something about the Dallas Brass.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, right. Well, I did some subbing with them back in the early 90s. And one of their concerts that I was subbing on was here at Chautauqua. They were invited guests to do a concert here at Chautauqua. And so that week I was playing with them. And they always did this, the last movement of the Mozart Quintet. Mm-hmm. And arranged for the brass quintet. And so I was, you know, playing that part. And it just so happens that Tom Bacon was subbing as principal horn that summer. And Chuck Waddell, who's the third horn player here, they both came to the concert. And, you know, they both said nice things when it was over. Well, that was, thank you, blah, blah, blah. And Tom took me out for pizza afterwards. At that time, the one restaurant there was kind of up here in those days, Andreaccio's, which I know you know about.
I know Andreaccio's. That's where I had my 22nd birthday or something.
Oh, probably. Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah.
Can't believe it's that long ago. Oh, I mean last year. Sorry, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that's it. Anyway, so the concert's over, blah, blah, blah. So in the meantime, I go back home, and I'm living in Texas. I'm living in Waco at the time. And I get a phone call. I had finally made it to Ithaca by then. That's right. I was actually in Ithaca by then. And I got a phone call that said they would like to have me come out and do some auditions. And it turns out after I talked to Chuck Waddell, he's the one that sort of recommended me because of that concert I played with the Dallas Brass. So anyway, the rest of history. I play as assistant principal here and have since 1998, I guess. And it's great out here. So we play a ton of concerts every summer, except for this summer. Right. And we keep very busy.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I got to tell you, that summer at Chautauqua was one of my favorite summers ever, not just as a student and all that stuff. I just had such a great time. And that orchestra, the CSO, is just so great. I mean, you guys are playing concert after concert after concert with like minimal rehearsal, like one rehearsal or two rehearsals, playing Mahler 6, yeah, and just heavy stuff. And it was amazing. As a student, you know, those practice rooms were so much fun. You're just out and it'd be raining or it'd be whatever, and you're just playing in the peaceful practice outdoors.
You'd be happy to know now those practice shacks are all air conditioned and revamped inside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can actually go there and be there as opposed to I can't wait for your practice session to be over because it's so hot.
Right. Yeah, man. Well, that was a lot of fun. Is Andreaccio still there?
Andreaccio is going strong. Okay, they've got a nice outdoor seating area now, which is good because that's how they have to eat in New York State and outdoors.
Now, who was Principal Viola? He was like with the LA Phil and...
the Principal Viola... oh, gosh, now I can't say his name. You put me on the spot, and I can't
Sorry,
say
Sorry, man. I didn't mean to.
He retired a couple of years ago, though.
Okay. Well, I just remember, like, one vivid time at Andreaccio's. There were a bunch of us students sitting in there. I mean, it was a packed restaurant. And we go, and we had eaten already, and we had some drinks and all this stuff. And, you know, us students, I mean, we're always aware of how much money you've got left, you know. I didn't show up to Chautauqua with a whole bunch of money, that's for sure. So I remember having dinner and I was like, oh, okay, well, we're going to pay. And then he got up and he just paid for the entire restaurant of students. Like he took everybody's tab, like the entire restaurant. I couldn't believe it. All of us were just like, wow, what a baller, man. We want to be like that guy. Now I can't remember his name. So I'm such a jerk. I remember him. Yeah, I thought he was Principal Viola of the LA.
You know, I think you might be thinking not of our Principal Violas, but I think of somebody who was who came in either as soloist or was playing that week with us.
Okay, I know he was playing soloist. He played Harold in Italy.
Yeah, so he would have been one of our soloists then, because our principal was not from LA.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
Yeah. I do remember we've had a couple of violists here, and one of them, in fact, this guy's come back a couple of times, but we're both so good, we can't remember his name.
Yeah. Well, that was really cool. But I know that you love going up to Chautauqua. It's for any, if there are any students listening and you're looking for summer institutes to go to, I mean, you're not going to regret going to Chautauqua. It's beautiful. The musicians are top notch and it's just, I mean, it's a blast.
The college orchestra is a fantastic experience. They do five concerts and as Chris can tell you, they play gigantic repertoire. Yeah. And the personnel are just fantastic. I mean, it's a great sounding orchestra. Yeah. And it's fun to play with. So yeah, I definitely recommend it no matter what you play.
And the year that we went, I actually just talked to Jeff Scott. And the year that we went, the Imani Winds came in and they worked with us. And that was the first time I had met Jeff. I was a student and he coached me and coached the quintet and stuff. So that was a fun memory I got to share with him. But they have great chamber groups that come in also and work with the brass and woodwinds.
Right.
Yeah, man. So let's work backwards a little bit. You had done a little stint with the Dallas Brass. Now, how did that come about?
Now at this point in time, I was in Texas, but I was in Corpus Christi at the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember... Maybe I'll think of it in a second, but I was just standing in my kitchen one day back in the day when you had to pick your telephone up off the wall and push buttons and stuff on the side of the phone.
The brown or the yellow telephone.
Right. Mine might have been yellow. I can't remember, but it's on the kitchen wall nonetheless. And it was Mike Levine giving me a call.
Good old Mike.
And he asked me if I could play a week with them. And I don't know if I should tell the story or not. I probably won't tell the story exactly, but
tell the story.
But it's just a story, and most brass players know it. They used to know it. Now it's probably kind of forgotten. But on my first rehearsal, we flew to Youngstown, Ohio, and I was going to be on tour with them for a week, and they were going to pay me what I thought was a really nice salary for the week. So I was real happy. I was really into this, you know. And so I got out to Youngstown with those guys, and we're in our first rehearsal up in some room at some building somewhere. And at the break of the first rehearsal, principal trumpet, tuba player, and the drummer, they all take me aside, and uh-huh. They say, Bill, we're all quitting tonight.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm sitting there going, oh. Okay, what am I supposed to do here? I'm supposed to get a cab to the airport now or what? So anyway, yeah, but it turns out that they had decided at that point in time, those three guys had decided to create the Rhythm and Brass. Right. Because they wanted to kind of go do their thing a little bit. But they finished out the week. And thank goodness that was the next sentence out of their mouth was, but we're going to play out the week.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but anyway, so I did that tour for a week, and I probably did maybe 8 to 10 trips with those guys as life went on. But then they started to, as with any ad lib job, you have to say no a couple times because you have a real job. I was teaching at first of all, I was teaching at Del Mar College, then I was teaching at Baylor. I did for a while. I was up in Waco, and they still called me, but. Finally, I said no one too many times, and they didn't call me back anymore. It was fun. I really enjoyed it. We had a good time. I got to see a lot of cool places with those guys. It was fun.
Yeah. Well, it's a really great group. I mean, and it's a lot of fun to play in that group. They're very show-oriented, not just music-oriented. So you learn a lot about stage presence, and you learn a lot about things other than just standing up and playing.
Yeah. You know. That was definitely a fun part of it. I had a good time with that. I especially liked it when we'd run out into the audience during Sing, Sing, Sing. I don't know if you were with them or not.
Oh, yeah. Still do it, probably.
I say some things never end with certain groups. So. Yeah. But that was always fun to go out and do that. The audiences would love it. I don't think we ever didn't play to a packed house anywhere we went. So they had something going on back in those days, and they still do for all I know. But it was fun. Had a good time. Charlie Villarubia, Whiff Rudd. You know, those guys were fun to get to know and play with. I kind of knew those guys from a little previous lifetime anyway, which is probably why Mike called me. They probably let's try Bill. He's probably not doing anything. So hey.
Now, had you had experience with quintets before that?
Well, not that kind of quintet, but I mean, not the showbiz kind of quintet. But yeah, I played quintets all my life, and every college job I had until UNLV we had a, I played in a brass quintet, so, and a woodwind quintet. It's not until I got to UNLV to the brass quintet end. And even for the first several years here, we had a wind quintet. So, so yeah, I was quite versed in the medium.
So when did you begin playing the horn? I mean, well, you don't have to know a year or anything like that, you know, if you don't.
Well, I'd have to do some math to do the years. I mean, if your audience's parents weren't even alive, I think, when I started doing this.
Well, what age were you?
I was actually 9 years old in, where I grew up. I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, and they started band in fifth grade. And I was one of those young people. I started kindergarten when I was 4 years old because my birthday was in late December. And my parents thought I should kind of get going instead of being a really old, big kindergartner. They wanted me to kind of, because I was moderately large size for my age. So I started in fifth grade and I just kept going from there. I remember Gib Anderson was our band director. He was a jazz trumpet player in Topeka, a great player. And he was our band director. And he's one day he says, oh, I'm going to choose an assistant conductor for the band. And he looks at his notes and he goes, I want William Bernardis to do it. So next thing you know, I was conducting the band like this, like I knew what I was doing at all. You know,
oh, that's awesome, man.
Fifth or sixth grade, I don't remember.
So do you remember why you chose the horn?
Yeah, I mean, it was a couple of reasons. The biggest reason probably was just through conversations with my mom. Turns out she played French horn in junior high school.
Oh.
But that's it. You know, like a couple of years in junior high school, that's it. You know, we didn't have the horn or anything anymore. And from that point on, I just sort of, well, okay, that sounds interesting. And then when what they used to do is they had films that they would, when they tried to recruit for the bands, they'd come to the fourth grade classes and they would show these films of instrumentalist orchestras and bands and stuff. And I remember there was this one scene where there was, I don't know what we just watched the scene before that, but suddenly the shot flipped to four horn players sitting backstage somewhere, emptying their slides on the floor. And I'm going, okay, that's interesting. Now I really want to be a horn player. if I can drip spit out of my slides, I want to be a horn player.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome, man. Were you into it when you started, or did it take you a little while to get like kind of like bit by the bug or something?
I think in those days I never really thought about it. I think I was pretty decent at it from the very beginning. I mean, I took lessons. We all took lessons in Topeka. If you were in a band, and it wasn't like the band directors said, go take lessons. We just all did it. But right. I will say this. We'd take a 30-minute lesson, and it was $2.
Oh, nice.
Every year it went up like 25 cents. So the next year it was $2.25, then $2.50. Finally, it got up to $3.50 and $4. By the time I was in college, of course, I was in college, but I was paying not quite $5 a lesson for lessons.
Now you're talking rich stuff.
No, I think I always enjoyed it. It was always fun. And as I got into high school, I sort of realized that the horn parts were kind of interesting and fun to be in. Of course, we also did a lot of sousa back in those days, so I really learned my E-flat horn and my offbeat.
Do you remember a time when you realized that you wanted to become a horn player or go to school for that?
Well, yeah, I don't remember, not a specific time, I don't think, but it was in high school. I realized I was pretty good. I played, when I was in ninth grade, I went to the, we had junior highs there, so junior high was seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. So realistically, I was not in high school as a ninth grader.
That's how my daughter's is here in Utah.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah. I didn't think they did that anymore. Okay.
I'm glad also because, you know, I don't want my daughter, she's in ninth grade now, I don't want her hanging out with those boys who are 18 or.
Yeah, I hear you. That's a thing. I don't mind telling you.
Yeah.
So anyway, when I was in ninth grade, I played Villanelle for my offering.
Okay.
In the state solo and ensemble. And, you know, I got a one. And I'm thinking, this is fun. This is cool. So basically, I kept getting ones at the state solo and ensemble. We didn't, you know, high school in those days was so different in terms of the activities and stuff that we had to do. you know, we didn't have marching band 8 days a week, four times a day. We didn't do that kind of stuff at all. We had maybe three times a week in band class, you know. Right. But when I discovered that maybe I felt pretty good about it, I also wanted to be a math teacher. Then I got into calculus, and that changed my whole outlook on the idea of being a math teacher.
I never got that far. I don't think I ever even got to trigonometry or anything like that. You know? But you must have been pretty darn good as a student to be playing Villanelle when you're in ninth grade. I think in ninth grade, I didn't even know what that was or anything.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how good I was either, but I do remember this. I played it at solo and ensemble, like I said, but then I don't even remember this. My dad told me that I also played it at my ninth grade graduation at the graduation ceremony. I don't remember doing this at all. Apparently it's one of those things where the horrible things that happen to you get purged from your brain. He said, you really didn't do very well.
Oh, no.
This is my dad, who was not a musician. I was really the only musician in my family. My brother, my oldest brother, played trombone through high school, but then that was it. So I was really the only musician. My mom played piano.
Okay.
So I don't know that my family was the best critics in the world.
Well, sometimes it's the non-musicians that are the best critics to be listening to, at least. Musicians don't come to your concerts. It's the non-musicians who come to concerts and pay. So when you went to college, where did you go?
Oh, well, like I said, I grew up in Topeka. So we had a university there called Washburn University. But I also had this good friend. His name is Bruce Penner. Bruce, if you're listening, I know you're not because he's a drummer. But he...
Nobody's listening, man.
Oh, they will. They're going to listen, man. There's no doubt about it. Anyway, so Bruce and I were friends all through junior high school because he moved in up the street from me on Mulvane in Topeka. And we would, here's a blast from the past for you, but this way before your past. Every Friday at 6:30 p.m., we'd make sure we got together up at his house and we would watch Star Trek. Every Friday, we watched Star Trek and we played games and stuff down in his sub basement. So it was fun. Anyway, so we were good friends, but then we actually went to different high schools. We did all this in junior high. We went to different high schools, and we kept in touch, and we weren't buddies like we were in junior high. But then when it came time to audition for colleges. He went to Kansas University, went to KU, but he said, you know, you should think about going to Wichita State. We got a good horn teacher down. He's telling me this, and he's a drummer.
Right.
I was just all set to go to Washburn, you know, and do it. So I've been taking, my lessons had been with the trumpet professor at Washburn, you know, almost all my life, except for my fifth and sixth grade years. But anyway, so I auditioned. I drove down. I had a 1962 red VW Bug. It was about a three-hour drive from Topeka to Wichita.
You can make a three-hour drive in a VW Bug?
I did it, man. I'll tell you about
that. How you can fit into a VW Bug, man.
Hey, no, there's more room than you think of those things. Okay. There's nothing in them. Including seat plush. Anyway.
For those of you who don't know, sorry to interrupt, but those of you who don't know Bill, he's a tall fella. It's not like he's a rotund fella. He is very svelte, but he is a tall guy. So.
Yeah, so anyway, I went down, auditioned, and they offered me a scholarship. So I actually went to Wichita State for my freshman year. I was actually in a marching band and really had a good time down there. It's a really good music school. Someplace else I would recommend for people who want to go somewhere and check it out. But then for some reason, I remember they got a new chair of the music department at Washburn who was a horn player.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to thinking about this because, you know, it was expensive even in those days for my parents to help me go to school down there. And I didn't really feel like they needed to necessarily do that. So I kind of decided, you know, I think I'll check this guy out. And I liked him. So I ended up going back to Washburn and finished my degree at Washburn, my undergraduate degree in music education there. And I'm happy I did because I really enjoyed the teacher. And I actually had a couple other teachers there that really – the clarinet professor, for instance, and the cello professor, they really are the ones that pushed me to go to graduate school. As soon as I graduated, I started teaching. I went to a little high school in Leavenworth, Kansas, where I actually spent some of my formative years when I was like 2 years old up through first grade in Leavenworth. And I went there and taught at a parochial Catholic high school down there. Yeah, that didn't work out so well. it was mostly a choir job, and it just didn't work out. So I decided I'd move back to Topeka, and I was married at the time too, and had a daughter. And I made pizzas for about a year and a half. I worked for Pizza Inn. Then these other teachers, including mine, the clarinet professor, the cello teacher, and my professor, they all pushed me to go to graduate school. So I taught for 3 years, made pizzas for a year and a half. So I went to graduate school. I went to IU, and that's where they really pushed me to go. And I'm getting very happy about that. I got to study with Phil Farkas. Mm-hmm. And that was, for me, a really terrific experience. Because he really knows how to talk to people who are trying to get out into the real world and get jobs. And he wouldn't mince words. If you did something you shouldn't be doing, he said, you don't do that. But he was a gentleman and a scholar, loved him to death. And when I graduated, he retired. So I guess he'd had all he could handle.
You retired him.
That's right, kind of. So that's kind of my education at a glance. I did some doctoral work at North Texas. In fact, I shouldn't say some. I almost finished my doctoral degree at North Texas. I had like two recitals and a paper to write, and that's about it. So,
man, so studying with Phil Farkas. So, I mean, that's like studying with, I mean, a legend. You know, was there anything in particular that he brought that you are really, really fond of?
Just unbelievable knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, he was a legend and still is a legend. He's not as prominent as he was. I mean, back in those days, he was like the first generation of all those fantastic orchestra people that were recruited by colleges to go teach at them.
Right.
Indiana was one of the ones that really, they got a whole bunch of those guys. That's why it became the great school that it became. Mm-hmm. People wanted to go study there with all the famous orchestra people. But no, if you've ever read The Art of French Horn Playing, just imagine those words sitting next to you in a chair, spewing forth the wisdom and the common sense things that he did. But one of the things that really, there was two things he said to me. Well, one thing he said, another thing that he did. One of the things he said to me, because I asked him, the Con 8Ds were the big thing. I grew up on a Con 8D. I bought a Con 8D for myself in like the 10th grade, and as I played it for 30 years. I played this horn, this same
when
horn.
I first met you, you were playing the silver-plated 8D.
Yep, and that was the second one I had, actually, because the one that I bought that horn in like 1970, and it got stolen in about 1985. So I guess I had it for 25 years, and then it got stolen. But anyways, and then the one you saw was the second one I had. But anyway, I asked him, because everybody's playing 8Ds. Either played an 8D or you had Holtons, because those were the horns that were there. There's a few Reynolds out there, and some people were playing 28Ds that they put different lead pipes on, blah, blah, blah. So I said, should I get a different horn? What kind of a horn should I have? Mm-hmm. You know? And he goes, you know, you should get a horn you like and learn to play it well. And that was his comment. That has stuck with me, you know. Because the more I thought about it over the years, but it really meant it meant the same thing to me at that time, is that it's not the horn, it's the player.
Yep.
Yeah. I obviously you can't play on a piece of junk.
Right.
You know? You've got to have a horn that knows how to do what it's supposed to do. But you're the one that tames it and makes it become you, basically. So yeah. That was a big deal to me. The other thing was I asked him, and this is sort of a thing he said and a thing he did, because I was getting ready to go take some auditions. And it never occurred to me that I could take an audition whenever I wanted to. I thought I had to get some schooling and have somebody tell me it's time to go take an audition. But anyway, I asked him, am I supposed to memorize these excerpts for the auditions? And he goes, no, you're supposed to learn them. Okay. So that's another big thing for me, you know, because because learn is a completely different concept than playing and practicing. Because he always used to say, first you practice, then you learn.
Right.
And then that's a big deal. But what he would do in lessons, and he did this regularly, is I'd be sitting there playing, I don't know what it would be, Shostakovich. Oh yeah, specifically Shostakovich, for instance. Mm-hmm. The half note one. I'd play it, and he'd go, "Oh, it's very nice." Very blah blah. And start over again. So he's sitting a little bit behind me. So I go, da di da da. Even though the flute starts it. he joined me with the flute part and just play it. He'd play clarinet parts for me. He'd play flute parts for me. He'd play violin parts for me. Wow. While I'm reading my excerpts.
Not learn what you're just playing, but learn everything that's going on.
Know the excerpt. And something that my undergraduate professor had me do, which I may have had a couple people try to do it here, but it's a lot. Now I should, because it's easier. He would have me make reel-to-reel excerpts of these things. So if I had to go do Till Eulenspiegel, he would say, do 30 seconds before, 30 seconds after. Well, so which means I have to do the introduction to the excerpt, and then do the excerpt, and then 30 seconds after, and with any excerpt. And you had to go search for these things. I'd have to get a score. Like if it's from an opera, well like, right. Bup, 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 where is that in the opera?
Exactly, yeah. Wow.
So you've got to get a score, and you've got to figure out where it is on the multiple records that Siegfried would be.
Yeah, so you couldn't pop onto IMSLP and just type in the thing that you want and automatically have the music. And you couldn't just go onto YouTube and type in the specific excerpt and have it pop up. I mean, sure. This isn't a time when you had to be motivated to do something if you wanted to do it, because it took legwork. It wasn't just like right there at your fingertips.
Exactly. And that legwork is what really helped me learn more than I would have learned otherwise, just by playing, you know, because I grew up on those three Patek books where you got just the excerpt, right?
Yeah.
Which is great. There's a ton of excerpts in there. And I play. It reminds me, I'm thirsty.
Sorry, I'm good at remembering that I'm thirsty.
So yeah, it was really good, and I still have that reel to reel on my shelves at school right now. I just need to get a tape deck and maybe put all those things on a digital format.
I'd love to hear that, man. I remember actually being in your office. You always had some cool, like, mysterious stuff sitting around, and you had a bunch of really old mouthpieces.
Not a single thing has changed. So mysterious.
Yeah. So, what was your first college teaching job?
Well, my first job, when I graduated from Indiana University, two things happened at that moment. I'm not quite going to answer your question for the second here.
Okay, that's all good.
But one of the band directors at IU, his name was Fred Ebbs. He was a kind of an icon in the band director world, in the country and in the world, actually. He got me, I was going to go up for an audition for the National Symphony. On a certain date in, like, we'll just say it's March 15th. I have no idea what it was. And it just so happens the Marine Band was going to have auditions March 22nd, a week later. So Fred calls up, and because he knew Bourgeois, we all love and adore, and he got me a private audience with Bourgeois and his assistants the week I was going to be up there early.
Oh, wow.
So I finished my audition with the National Symphony, and I walked from that auditorium over to the Marine base, which they're not that far apart. And I walked over there, and I see these two guards with their red uniforms on, their dress uniforms, and no hair, man. They're intimidating. Back in those days, you shave your head, you're watch out. So I walked in, did the audition, blah, blah, blah. And in the meantime, I had already gone down for an interview at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi, Texas.
Okay.
And so I was actually now waiting to hear about three things. And during that next week, actually, it was about a week later, it was about the time the actual auditions happened, Del Mar offered me the job, and I took the job. And 2 days later, I find out the Marine Band wants to offer me the job also.
Really?
Yeah, but I'd already taken the Del Mar job, and I'd done the math. I mean, the salary back in those days in the Marine Band was like $11,000 plus housing and meal allowances, which brought the salary up to maybe $17,000 or $18,000. You know, right. And I was going to make probably $3,000 or $4,000 more at Del Mar College.
Okay. Although by now you would have been you would have been the president or something, E70 or whatever. That's crazy. So you won a job in the Marine Band by taking a personal audition with the colonel. You know, he's a horn player.
I do know. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you had to be extra good, man.
Well, you know, the one of the mainstays that they asked for at every audition, because I knew this ahead of time anyway, was the long call from Siegfried. They made you play the long call. And, wow. And they made you read some band pieces and whatnot, which is fine. But then the long call was like the last thing you did. And I was pretty good at it in those days. I could play it.
Hey, you still can, man. I mean, that's one of the things about you is you have really incredible stamina as a horn player. And also the sound that you produce projects, and it's soloist sounding, and it's really impressive when I hear you play. That's why I think that you make such a great chamber player also, and a soloist, because of that sound that you get.
Appreciate that. Thanks.
Nah, man. I mean, so I can understand why somebody who's a horn player like him, although he was a conductor, obviously, would want somebody who can really just lay it down and really project through a band. Because in band music, I mean, you're competing with a whole lot more than you are with an orchestra, in my opinion. I mean, it's like you got a whole row of trumpets and trombone, like a battle station of like all these like front belled instruments right behind you, and you have to project over that instead of just an orchestra where it's maybe three trumpets and three trombones or whatever.
It's hard. Yeah, all the bands at IU, they insisted on having eight horns. They stuck them in the middle of the band.
So. Yep. That's awesome. So what brought you to Las Vegas?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I guess you could say my wife, perhaps.
And you were teaching at Ithaca at the time, right?
Yeah, I actually met my lovely wife at Baylor. I was teaching there. I was in my sixth year, and she was doing a one-year bassoon replacement because our former bassoonist decided to leave. Uh-huh. So she was there as the one-year interim person, and we both basically split at the end of the year. I shouldn't say we split up. We started a relationship, and then we went opposite directions because I got a job teaching at Ithaca College in a tenure-track position there. And she got a job at UNLV as the tenure-track bassoonist. So we both had jobs that we wanted, and there you have it. But we kept our relationship going. We actually got married at the end of our first year apart. So we were married living apart, and then we did that for two more years. And it finally got to the point where one of us was going to have to move. Because we couldn't do this anymore, you know, 3 years apart now, basically, two of them being married. And so anyway, we kind of talked it over, and we kind of decided that she would come to Ithaca. But then about the time we made that decision, another one of your former teachers, Lynn Bett, decided to leave UNLV. She was the horn professor there, as you know. I'm telling everybody else, you know this.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, that's right. I heard that somewhere. Yeah, fantastic person, fantastic hornist, fantastic teacher all the way around. But anyway, she left. She and her husband went to North Carolina, and he went to the North Carolina School for the Arts, and she did some playing and teaching there as well. And they're still there. So the UNLV position opened, so I applied for it, and I went through all the rigmarole that you do when you apply for a position, and came for an audition and played, and they offered me the job. So that's how I got to Las Vegas.
Yeah, man. Well, I remember meeting you for the first time. It was before you started teaching at UNLV, and it was the very first concert that the new Las Vegas Philharmonic had done, I think they just celebrated their 20th anniversary?
I think 20, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was the very first concert that they did, and we were playing Mahler 1, and you're on my left, and we get to the part where everybody stands, and your bell is head level with me, like it was right.
That's the reason I hate playing that piece.
Oh, man, I just remember, man, I'm like 5'10", this guy's like 6'3", and I'm really not that fixated on height. I know I have been.
Yeah, whatever you say, Chris.
I know, I'm sorry. Small man complex. No, it was hilarious. I just remember we're standing up, and not only are you such a great player, and you're like really laying it down, but you're really laying it down right into my head, and it was awesome. And so right after that, Lynn had told me that she was going to be leaving the school, and then they were having auditions. And I remember you coming in and auditioning. Hey,
look at that. Hey, Orion.
This is the second time that he's made an appearance on one of these things.
I want to play outside with
you. Okay, hold on. We're going to pause for a second here.
Okay, put the elevator music on.
Yeah, get the elevator music going.
He's such a cutie, man. He's funny.
At least he had clothes on this time.
Oh, now I do feel honored.
Yeah, his new thing is that he likes to just walk around the house naked. I remember the first time I just went upstairs out of my office, and I walked into the living room, and there Orion is in all his glory. And I said, Orion, where'd your clothes go? And he goes, oh, Dad, we're all family here. Like, all right, but I get, you're not wrong. All right, so where were we? Oh, I remember. Okay, so I remember your audition when you came in, because I was a student at the university, and the students got to sit in on the auditions and watch your recitals and stuff, and then the teachers would do a Q&A with us afterwards about who had just played. And I remember your recital, and you sounded great, and I remember them asking, out of the candidates, who would you want to study with? And I remember just telling them, if you were asking me, who do I want to play like, it's Bill. And they're like, okay, well, so, and what do you think about the teaching style and stuff? Once again, if you're asking who I would like to sound like, it's Bill Bernardes. And now, I mean, 20 plus years later, we've played countless gigs together, and you've just been and still are just a real inspiration in your playing. If you guys don't know his playing, you should check out his YouTube channel and or his Facebook page, which is the Etude. It's some really scary stuff. I mean, it's scary good. He plays all 48 Vern Reynolds Etudes at tempo, which is unheard of. It's very difficult process to just get through those books, and that's part of the point. I mean, they're interval studies, they're supposed to take a really long time, lots of repetition, and you get them to the point that you can play at whatever tempo that is. Suffice it to say, there aren't too many people who can play those things at tempo like that. And now you've been doing all the Alphonse books, and it's just really fun to hear those things the way they're supposed to sound.
How something is supposed to sound is, that's subjective, obviously. Mm-hmm. I definitely play them the way I like to play them. And, and one thing I try to make sure that I do when I talk about music and how it's performed is I don't do anything the way it's supposed to be done. Actually, if I recorded those things all over again, which I am not going to do, by the way, they would all sound a little different, you know, just because, okay. Not because of several years later, but because each time I do it, it's not quite the same. But how did I get into the project? Well, I was just, again, this is back in the early days. These things have been recorded for a long time. Things happened at UNLV that sort of kept me from getting them published, so to speak. I mean, when I say things happened, I became particularly busy. I was assistant director, assistant chair, and I was just really busy with school stuff. And I just wasn't motivated, I guess you could say, to finally get these things finished and out. And I finally got to the point where I did it, finally. So anyway, so how did it get started? Well, this is many, many years ago. Digital recording was brand new. It was a thing that was coming in. I mean, not too many years before, I would have recorded all these things on reel-to-reel tape.
Well, you recorded these on DAT, right?
I had ADAT tapes, yeah. A DAT tape was something about smaller than a cassette tape. I remember cassette tapes. This is like this. An yeah. ADAT tape was actually a VHS size tape. It would accept more digital data, basically, and they ran a little faster. You've seen them. I've got probably 20-some ADAT tapes up on my shelf up there.
Yeah, the gray boxes.
That's right. But by the time the project got finished, I was actually recording directly into my computer because that technology came on so fast.
Yeah.
Anyway, so why did I do it? Because I was thinking, what can I do that's not just another person putting four Mozarts out on a CD mm-hmm. or playing the slow romantic songs that they can record without making too much trouble? And I felt like there was a void for people who don't get to go to Indiana University, that don't get to go to a school where there's a teacher who can really lay technical things down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So my concept was that I would record these virtuosic etudes so people could kind of get to hear what these things would sound like if they don't have a teacher that would or will do it for them. Yeah. And that's where the concept came from. Originally, I was going to try to expand it into all the brass instruments and, you know, have a trumpet series and a trombone series, but life just got in the way. Didn't quite get that to happen, you know. But that's kind of where it came from. I wanted to try to do something different that was pedagogical and put it out there. So the two sites you mentioned, the YouTube and the Facebook site, I think if you were to type in Bill Bernardus, the etude, they would come right up. I think if you just type in the etude, you might get some other things to come up first. I'm not sure. But anyway, the Kling books, the 40 etude Kling books, I'm going to put those up because they're all done, ready to roll.
I love that book.
Yeah, well, it's everybody loves the Mueller book. The Mueller book is the next one. Anyway.
Okay. It's incredible because not only are you, as I mentioned before, a great solo player, and one of the things that I think is really important about your Alphonse recordings is that you're really thoughtful in the places where you breathe and take some time so that you can make these passages happen. It's not like, oh, this guy doesn't breathe. You're playing it in a way that is completely possible if you work your ass off. You know what I mean? And practice.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I mean, take the first etude in the Kling book, for instance. There's no place to breathe in that anywhere, ever. So I try to invent ways to make a breath make sense. Da dee da 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 da, da dee da 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 da, da dee da 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 da, da dee da 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 da, where the breath fits in somehow if you can't make it all the way.
And it's very musical.
Yeah, and that's what I love to play. That's why I like Book Six, especially in the Maxine books, is those things are just, they're just built for me. I love to play ultra squishy romantic.
It puts that musicality together with this virtuosic technicality that you in particular can really bring together. It's really impressive, dude.
It's all just fun for me. All these things that I recorded for these etude pages is stuff I've just played all my life. I love to read. I read, and I've played these things. Like, take the Vern Reynolds. I didn't just pick up that book and record them.
Right.
I'd been playing that book for years.
But I think that a lot of people read and read, but not everybody really perfects them, you know? And that's what I really appreciate, because I love to read stuff also. But when I started listening to you play them, especially the Maxime Book 6, those are ones that I've never really gotten under my fingers and able to play. I've just kind of read them. And man, what a difference. I remember listening to you play the first one. I'm like, holy crap, I need to revisit this. This is what it's supposed to sound like. This is awesome. And it's really inspiring. And I think that what's going on right now with the COVID-19 pandemic and everything, there's a plus side to it. If you are a motivated person, this can be a personal renaissance. And that's kind of how I'm looking at it. There are a lot of things about my life that I wanted to straighten out and that were not so easy to do when you're on the road 200 days a year. But when you're stuck at home, you can kind of like reevaluate yourself and just say, look, I've been meaning to do this, whether it's personal health or it's playing wise. I've wanted to experiment with hand position and just being able to project more with less effort. But I couldn't do that in between tours or anything because I can't really change a major thing about my playing before I have to go play a big concert. So anyway, I don't know why I got started on that, but
no, that's great stuff. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons that I was a good reader is because, you know, I wasn't playing for a living and I wasn't on the road 200 days a year. And I could spend that time exactly the way you're talking about. If I needed to, well, you know my routine.
Yep.
That routine was born from me not being able to do things as well as I wanted to. So
right.
Every single thing in that routine was built to make me get better. So same thing with these etudes. I wanted to be able to play them perfectly, if I dare put a word like that out there, which I know they're not that, but I had the time to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have to worry about other performances, you know, so much. But no, I think what you're saying is so true. If we get the time, and who knows how long this time will last, we can really make good use of it.
Well, let me ask you something. After you were, let me go way back to the beginning of our conversation when you were with Dallas Brass. Did you ever think about going into chamber music, or were there any other opportunities to play with groups like that?
Oh, well, yeah, my first big opportunity, which I, again, was right on the cusp of having, was with the Empire Brass. Back in the, again, the mid-80s, I had the good fortune of contacts. The Empire Brass came to Del Mar College, and it just so happens that Sam Palafian and Bill Pickering, one of our colleagues at Del Mar College, they knew each other. I think they were friends. So Sam and the group came to town. Dave Ohanian was not with them at the time on that particular trip. But anyway, we all went out to dinner after their show, and conversation started to happen. And basically, I got an invitation to go to their Tanglewood summer camp as a member of their assistant quintet, which basically meant we did all the teaching and those guys showed up to rehearse and say, "Hi, we're the Empire Brass."
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I did two summers with them.
Oh, cool.
As in this assistant quintet.
Do you remember who was playing horn at the time?
Well, Dave was playing.
Okay.
Actually, I'm trying to remember the timeline, how this happened, actually. It was Dave and Marty. This is how this happened. At the end of my first summer, great, I get a call in like October.
Uh-huh.
"Bill, we're gonna be in Kingsville." This is Sam, right? "Bill, we're going to be in Kingsville. Dave's leaving the group. We want to hear you play." They wanted to have an audition. And Dave was not on this trip either. So I think Kevin Owen was the one that might have been playing with them again. He kind of subbed for Dave a lot. He was one of Dave's students.
Okay.
But anyway, so I went down there and basically went to the first half of the show. During the intermission, I auditioned for these guys.
What? During the intermission?
During the intermission of the show.
Wow.
And it was hot down there. And I remember we went into this little room. I can't remember exactly what it was, but basically they all took their coats and shirts off and they're all just sitting bare chested. And I'm playing. Da, 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 da. I don't know what I played, but anyway, I basically played for them. And when it was over, they said, "Okay, yeah, we're going to want to fly you out to Boston so we can listen to you do some auditions." Oh. Basically. So, okay, so make this long story shorter because people don't want to hear me keep going on about this kind of stuff. But I did the auditions, and it was me and Marty were the final two audition. And I thought I did great. And Tim Morrison was there. You know, he was trumpet. I went home thinking, "Oh, this is great," and whatnot. And I thought the vibes are feeling good. So I get home a couple days later, "Sam, Bill, we're going to give the job to Marty," because he was with the Canadian Brass, right? So they were wanting to make it look like a flip-flop.
Yeah.
Canadian, Marty's going to go Empire Brass. And, you know, I'm sure he won the audition and all that stuff. But nonetheless, I was very close. But yeah, I was all set to move to Boston, man, because that job paid money. I was ready to do that.
Yeah. Sure. Well, Empire was on fire at the point, man.
Oh, they still, in my mind, are, as far as what a group can yep. sound like, is a, if not the best, certainly one of the best sounding groups.
Yeah.
And when Rolf was on, man.
Yeah. And not just brass playing, but just chamber music playing, period. I mean, right. they were incredible. And I remember having Canadian brass records and having German brass records and even Dallas brass and stuff. And then I heard Empire Brass, like maybe it was Class Brass or something. And I was just like, whoa, it was a game changer, man. And that was, of course, Marty was playing on that. And one of the funny things that I remember you saying about Marty was when he was auditioning, did he audition for Chautauqua or just?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. You were talking about how you guys were playing one of those movie music shows or something like that. And you're playing assistant. You're like, he just never needs to stop playing. He just keeps going and going like a Mack truck, man.
No steroids or something. He's so strong. Was so strong, you know?
Yeah. And he's such a good dude. I love Marty. Yeah. But, well, that's really interesting to hear. So you had the brush with Empire Brass. Now, who else have you played with chamber music-wise?
Most of my life, I played with the groups at my schools, and they've all been great. I've really had a good time doing that. And this, I think that's where I picked up most of my musicianship skills, is actually over my history of my life, playing with different people.
Yeah.
I played 2 years with the Breckenridge Chamber Orchestra in Breckenridge, Colorado.
Okay.
I did a little stint with the Burning River Brass. They were also looking for horn players, a horn player.
I remember actually when you went out with them.
Really? Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that was when I was at university.
I guess so. It's been a long time ago, but I guess that's right. You would have been there still probably. Yeah, I mean, obviously you were. You wouldn't have said that. So, yeah, but that was a lot of fun. That was my first playing gig with my Engelbert Schmidt horn that I bought, my E flat.
That's right.
But they didn't. They ended up not hiring anybody. I mean, they still haven't. They had two horn players. I guess they're just going with one. Yeah. Let's see. I did that stuff with the Utah Symphony. I love doing those Mahler symphonies that I did. I did four Mahler symphonies with those guys.
Yeah, and I know that you recorded Mahler 8 with them. And, I mean, what better choir to record?
Oh, my gosh. The horns, of course, sitting on the back, right? And in that tabernacle, the choir is like an inch from your ear, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd never really thought about how that piece starts before. You know, I know it starts with this great sound from the choir, but I literally jumped up when they sang. Yeah. I was sitting there with my horn in my hand, and they go, oh!
Well, I hope they didn't make that sound you just made.
It was the most startling yet glorious sound.
Well, I've played so many fun jobs with you in Las Vegas. And that's one of the cool things about Vegas, is just some of the unique gigs that you end up playing. But some of my favorite times were when you would play in a Phantom of the Opera with us. And we had Tom Snelson around. And I really wish he was still around for me to interview. Because he would be the ultimate storyteller.
No doubt.
But it's just the times that we had together were awesome, man. Do you have any favorite gigs or recordings that you've done over the years that you could talk about?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, one of the most memorable ones actually was with you again. You may remember the Blockbuster video out at the...
Yeah, out at like Bonnie Springs or something. Or
yeah, like 4:30 in the morning or something like that.
Yeah, it was ungodly early, man. Me and you were both thinking, what are we doing here? And for you, it was only like a 15-minute drive.
It's fine. You took me.
For me, it took forever to get there.
The thing that was so cool about that gig, the way it ended, I don't know if you remember this or not, but for those of you that don't know, it was a Blockbuster Video conference that was happening. For those of you who don't remember Blockbuster Video, they were really in business in those days.
Yeah, how are they doing now, baby? I got more money than Blockbuster does.
That's right. It's B-L-O-C-K anyway. So they're having a conference, and this is like a spirit building thing at 4:30 in the morning. So they had breakfast and all this. But anyway, it ended with some sort of an arrangement of Beethoven 9, mm-hmm. you know. So and the sun came up at that moment. It was amazing how it was timed.
I remember that. But you know what I remember even more than that was hanging out in that weird trailer that they had that we had.
Yeah. Around,
and all the other guys were in there and we were just telling stories and shooting the shit. It was fun.
I think as far as other cool things that I had a lot of fun doing was I went up to Seattle some years ago and I recorded the soundtrack of Mirror, Mirror with, now I can't say who.
Julia Roberts or?
Yeah, that was, lady. I think that was the Julia Roberts one, I think.
Okay.
But I'm trying to say the composer. Anyway, he was there, and but it was such an interesting experience for me to do all that movie recording. And again, the Seattle people are such great musicians up there.
Yeah,
so it's a lot of fun.
Now in Chautauqua Symphony, is Mark Robbins still in the orchestra?
Yep, he is. We're touring with us. He's associate principal in Seattle.
Right.
Fourth horn for us, great fourth horn player.
I was going to say that's really pretty unique that he plays fourth horn in the Chautauqua Symphony, but in Seattle, so associate principal, is that what it is?
For a number of years when Chermanara was playing principal up in Seattle, Mark was fourth and associate principal.
Wow, man, what a great player.
He's a fantastic player. I guess I can include myself. We have five really excellent horn players here.
Yeah. Oh, you can definitely include yourself. Yeah, I remember taking lessons with Roger Causa was a big pleasure because I was hot off of really enjoying the Audition Improbable album.
Yeah.
I've always been intrigued with this like kind of like arranging stuff, multi-tracking stuff, just kind of, you know, having fun with it. Kind of thing. And man, that CD was way before its time. I mean, all the multi-tracking, all the other people that he had on it.
There's all the section of the Houston Symphony.
Yeah, and all the great arrangements. And
it turns out that his wife at the time, she's the one that couldn't play that tuning note.
Why do you remember him telling me that?
She, you know, if you listen to that hard, she never plays the E. Or the concert A. It's everything around it, but I didn't know it was her until many years later. He said, yeah, that was Patty. She was doing that.
Oh, my gosh. That's amazing. I loved that. I remember studying with him, but I was a little bit of a meathead, still am, when it comes to horn playing, and I love the hot dogging stuff. And I remember in the Horn Signal Symphony, he does that. It goes like all the way to like a double A, like up to this high A. And I remember sitting in the lesson, like just asking him, oh man, I loved that thing where he went up to that double A. Can you play it? And I just like ask him to play it for me. And now I would never do that. I, you know, it's, but
did he do it?
He played it. He was like, oh, let me see if I can. And he was just up to the double high A. And I was just like, oh, hell yeah, man. This guy is legit. So what's next for you, man? What do you have on the horizon?
Oh, what's next? Well, I am trying to finish the bathroom in my house. I have to put tile around the bathtub.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you for a second because those of you who, once again, if you do not know Bill, every time I go to Vegas, I stay in his casita with my wife, and he built this casita. It was just a garage, but now it's a casita, and it's like an apartment, like a straight up really nice apartment. And he built that, and you put in your floors in your house, and you built. I mean, it's just you're a super handy dude, and I am not that.
I own a nail, and I'm good. Anyway, as far as music goes. But I think my immediate projects are now finished in terms of what I have to do. I know the Chautauqua Symphony is going to do a couple of things over the summer. They're not codified yet. And there's actually a possibility of doing maybe some live performances on the Chautauqua grounds with small groups, you know, that are away from people.
Yeah. Well, you're there, so you might as well do it.
Yeah, that's true. Might as well. What the heck?
If you didn't go into music, what do you think you'd be doing right now?
I don't know. I've always had a dream of being the bass player in a rock band or the drummer.
Oh, I love the bass player,
drummer in a rock band. I don't know. I don't know. I'm afraid that if I hadn't have been a musician, that I might be doing something like being a CPA or something. I don't know. But what I would want to do, I don't know. I have not unenjoyed what I've done. Don't get me wrong. The path that I've been on, which is being a college professor and also someone who gets to do other stuff, I believe has made me the best musician I could ever be, frankly. I've gotten to do so many different kinds of music with so many different people and in different ways, and that has been a real joy for me. It's been a lot of fun. So it's definitely a path I would recommend to people.
That legacy that you're leaving of just information. I mean, everything that you're passing on is so important. I mean, that I've been fortunate enough to gain as a student of yours. And I would hope that someday I'd be able to pass that on to students in more than I do a lot of master classes and residencies, but there's something to be said for having a studio of your own and being able to foster students through 4 years or even 6 years if they do a master's with you or whatever it is, you know, and then you get to see them blossom into their careers. And that's incredibly satisfying, I've got to imagine. And I think that that's very important. I think that that's what academia is for. I think of people having apprenticeships, you know, it's like they don't have like this huge 40-person studio. They have like maybe a horn section worth or a double horn section worth of people, and they are providing them with all the tools to go on, you know, and it's up to them what they take. I would enjoy doing that at some point.
Yeah, you're kind of doing that now. You're such a high profile musician with what you do. You've got a huge following on Facebook and YouTube, and that your group goes out and sees people. You're doing that now, but I know what you're saying. You kind of would like to nurture a student through, but you're really leaving your mark, and that's good. And I'm sure one of these days you'll be leaving your mark for 4 or 6 years or more if they do their DMA. Who knows?
Yeah, well, hopefully. I got to tell you, this has been so much fun just chatting with you, talking with you. I mean, you're one of my favorite people, and every time I get to,
this is fun.
Oh, thanks, man. Every time I get to talk to you, I can't remember the last time I was hanging out with you and I didn't have just a blast, you know. So I really miss you, and I hope that the world can figure this pandemic thing out sooner than later so that we can all see each other in person again and just have a good time and play together like everybody wants to.
Right. Well, we can only hope. If we can keep doing the things we've been talking about until that happens, you know, that'll be good.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much. This has been Music on the Rocks, and I've been interviewing the great Bill Bernardis. He is a monster. Check him out on YouTube. Check him out on Facebook. On the Rocks, baby. Although my rocks have melted. I don't have
any. I got some left.
Oh, okay, good. So at Bill Bernardis at The Etude, and you won't be disappointed. It's really, really good stuff. And if you're looking for a person to study with, you're looking for a place to go where you're going to be taken good care of, and you're going to have somebody who you can really look up to as a player, you're going to want to think about UNLV. I had a great time there, a great education there. The band program is second to none. The orchestra program is great. They have an awesome jazz program, and the faculty is amazing from all over the place, and they're all great players. All right. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thanks, Chris. It's been a pleasure. Look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Sounds good, man. I'll catch you later.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.